Okay. Go ahead and try. Can you say your name for me and spell it?
Sure. Name is Maxie B. Carpenter, MaxieyCarpenter.
Perfect. Okay. So can you state your name and your rank and kind of, I guess, your platoon and group that you were in?
Sure. My name is Maxie B. Carpenter. The highest rank I attained was full colonel, which is also the grade of 06 in the military. The major units I served with was the 101st Airborne Division, the 3rd Ranger Battalion, and the 1st Special Forces Group. And that was over a span of 27 years from 1987 until this year, 2014.
Nice. Okay, so I'll start with some of the questions that were kind of required to have to ask you. So you just said which branch you're in. So obviously, I'm assuming you enlisted and weren't drafted.
That's correct. Yeah, I was a volunteer. I enlisted in 1984 when I was a student at the University of Washington in the reserves. And so I went to basic training and advanced training to be a cook, of all things, because I was still trying to figure out if I, really wanted to do the military. I wasn't quite sure. Then finished my degree at University of Washington and was commissioned an infantry lieutenant in 87.
Cool. What kind of inspired you to enlist?
I was an Army brat. So my father was in the military. I grew up around the world. And I was a little bit hesitant at first because I'd, been in an Army family. So I figured, well, that's why I enlisted to try it out in the reserves. And I figured, hey, this is a pretty good way to pay for college. And the initial plan was just to do my 4-year obligation to pay for school and I'd be done. And then, 27 years later, I finally was done.
So, just kind of from your bio that you gave me and stuff like that, and a little bit of research I did, I'm really interested if you can talk about it, like the stuff that you did in the Philippines and
Sure.
kind of around there and what you
Yeah,
were involved in.
absolutely. And the Philippines is an interesting story because this all happened right around 9/11, and the world was focused in Afghanistan, and that's, hey, that's where the show was. Well, I happened to be stationed in Okinawa, Japan, with a battalion of 1st Special Forces Group that was forward in Japan, so that's where we lived. Just prior to 9/11, we had done a mobile training team into the Philippines, where we were given, it was about a $2.2 million State Department mission to build a counterterrorism force for the Philippines. So we'd spent 7 months there from, it was from February until September of 2001. We were in the Philippines building this counterterrorism force, ironically. Then, of course, a few weeks after we finished the mission, 9/11 happened, the Twin Towers went down. Well, the main effort was to go into Afghanistan, but then the U.S. government, and through with some of the three-letter agencies, had determined that there was quite a few violent extremist organizations that trained throughout the southern Philippines and Malaysia and Indonesia, because Indonesia, is the largest Muslim country in the world. Well, so it's a kind of a safe haven and a training ground there down there where they can export. And the southern Philippines have always been in conflict, even since General Pershing around the turn of the 19th and 20th century, went in there to fight the Moros, which so the southern Philippines has always been Muslim, and then you have the northern part of the Philippines, which is Catholic, out of Manila. So there's a conflict. So the governing body is up, and they're all Catholic and Christian up in the north, and then they always are in conflict with the Muslims. Well, we were sent down to conduct Operation Enduring Freedom Philippines, which was interesting because you have a sovereign government with the Philippines, unlike Afghanistan, which was anarchy at the time. So we sent in a battalion, which is about 500 special forces and support, into the island of Mindanao and the island south of that. And that's where a few affiliated with Al-Qaeda terrorist groups, like the Abu Sayyaf group and Jamal Islamiyah, there's a couple of those groups that run around down there. And so we were sent in with about 500 guys to help the Filipino army, like combat, advise, and assist in the jungles to clean up that neighborhood, basically. So we deployed out of Japan and set up base camps in these tropical islands in the southern Philippines and in the advise and assist role. But we were under different rules of engagement than you would be in Afghanistan because we were still in a sovereign nation, the Philippines. So we could only use our weapons in self-defense and advise the Filipinos. So if we were taking incoming rounds, we could, of course, shoot back. But we couldn't be the initial aggressor. So it was more of an advisory and, steering the Filipino army in the right direction. So that went on. It's still going on to this day, in fact. Very low-level mission. It's been scaled back a little bit, but that's kind of what we did there. And I served in the southern Philippines after 9/11 from February of 2002 until May of 2002. And my job, I was the operations officer for the mission on three islands. The islands were Basilan, Jolo, and Tawi-Tawi were the three names of the islands, and chasing around the Abu Sayyaf group out there. So that was kind of that project. Neat mission. Fun place to, if you can call it a fun place to conduct operations. It beat the heck out of Afghanistan because it was actually tropical islands, white sand, and blue, you know, turquoise water. And, of course, yeah, there was a war going on, kind of a guerrilla-type war. But the kind of the neat thing about the fighting going on down there, it was both the enemy and the Army of the Philippines were semi-solar powered, meaning when the sun went down, they all went to sleep. So you didn't really have to worry about getting attacked at night, which was kind of convenient and helpful. So that and kind of is a summary of what we did. We were doing in the Philippines.
Cool. That's awesome. I didn't know anything about that about the Philippines.
Not many people do because it hasn't been advertised, and it's sort of a sideshow that just to, you know, to prop up but to assist a friendly government, friendly to the United States, and assist them and their trials and tribulations in their southern part of their country, which is, you know, rife with terrorist type organizations and a lot of organized crime and some other things. So
interesting. So what was kind of your first deployment that you ever did?
My first deployment, let's see.
You can remember now.
Yeah, exactly. It's been a while. Probably the first deployment was into Panama right at the end of Operation Just Cause, which went down in around Christmas time in 1989. That was when the president of Panama was a guy named Noriega, and he was anti-U.S., and he'd been harassing, you know, American service members that were stationed there. And then we, of course, invaded Panama. We got there right after the fighting finished, so that one wasn't much of a deployment. They just wanted to keep a continuous presence down there. And that was when I was with the 101st Airborne. So that was, you know, you were pretty excited to see if you're going to see some action, and then it was kind of a letdown when we didn't. And then fast forward about three more years after that, there was Operation Uphold Democracy. That was in Haiti. And that was when you had a legally elected president, a guy named Aristide, was put in power. But then the Haitian military had a coup de grace, and they took him out. Or they exiled him, you know, and took over. They had a little military junta. And that one, that was an interesting trip. That was probably the first big deployment because we had to go in, and you know, it was going to be a shoot 'em up, and then the Haitians kind of surrendered. But what my mission was, I had to take a Special Forces A team, which is 12 guys, and we had to fly from Fort Lewis, Washington to Kathmandu, Nepal, and pick up a battalion, about 400 Nepalese Gurkhas, because they were going to be part of the new UN force that was going to help out the Americans. So we had to stay in the Himalayas for about 6 weeks, training up these Gurkhas. And this was with a scuba team. I was like, what are we doing in the Himalayas, but whatever. So we trained up these guys, and then we load them on airplanes, and then we flew through Rota, Spain, and into Haiti. And then we were their advisors for 6 months in Haiti. And our job was patrolling the Port-au-Prince area. And Haiti's an interesting place. It could be a very beautiful place, but it's almost like if you took downtown Honolulu and dumped 10 feet of cow manure on it, it's just filthy. And, you know, it's just horrible. There's bodies laying around, and it's the tropical sun, and things blowed up and everything else. And it's kind of just a sad, sad story. So really that became more of a humanitarian mission than anything else, was just trying to get the water to work again and get the power back on and keep the looting to a minimum. And, you know, the most we ever got attacked by there was a couple crazies with machetes. And then they tried to come at us, and, you know, we had to take care of them and dispatch them. And then one time we were rolling through a village up in the mountains around Haiti, and they had this voodoo is very big there, and they all believe it. And there was this one voodoo priestess who was dancing around in the street out there, her eyes rolled back in her head, and, you know, all the villagers were terrified of her. And one of my sergeants next to me, he goes, "Hey, Captain Carpenter," I was a captain at the time, he goes, "watch this." So he took a Kim light, those things you get like at a rock concert, and he cut it open, and he sprayed the glow juice all over the witch. And she screamed and ran away because obviously our magic was more powerful. So we're big heroes to the villagers at that point. So that was the Haiti deployment. So it was kind of the Panama-Haiti thing back in the early 90s were some of the first trips overseas to go do something for the United States.
Cool. So you mentioned 9/11, mm-hmm. and I just find it an interesting question to ask anyone that was alive during it.
Sure.
So especially for the military. Yeah. Do you remember where you were?
Absolutely. I sure do, because I was in Honolulu, Hawaii, meeting with the State Department folks to settle the books for the seven-month mobile training team we had just completed in the Philippines. So we met halfway. The State Department accountants flew out from D.C. We flew in from Japan, and we met in Honolulu, which was, you know, kind of course, you're not going to get anybody to turn that one down. So we were going through the books of, you know, the $2.2 million we had spent on weapons and radios and training, and when the Twin Towers, of course, went down. And that was kind of interesting to see that because, you know, obviously air travel was, you know, halted worldwide for a couple of days. So here you've got tens of thousands of vacationers and their hotels up. And so you go to the Honolulu International Airport and people were just camping out as far as the eye could see. They couldn't leave Hawaii. And so it was interesting, really. But that's where we were, on the beach in Waikiki when 9/11 went down. So kind of put a downer on the whole deal. And it was interesting, too, because the beaches then were empty for about 3 or 4 days. Nobody really felt like hanging out and partying. And it was, you know, it was just an interesting time. It was kind of like the shock factor.
Yeah, I guess I've never thought about that, of, like, the people that were, you know, vacationing out, having a good time. Like,
right.
Now you're trapped on an island that has a history of being shot at. So,
yeah, exactly. Right.
Yeah. Do you remember kind of what you were feeling? Like, were you thinking ahead of, like, oh, we're probably all going to be sent there? Or?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that was one of those that you knew, okay, it was game on. And it was time to, you know, I guess the best way to put it is someone once said that at any given time, 2/3 of the world's population is awake, and some of them are up to no good. So I guess it was time to go out and get the no good, which for being a military person, you were pretty motivated to go and do that because it was like, wow, I mean, finally we get to go do our job, and it's something, you know, valid and real, and it means something. And you had the whole country behind you, you know, because everybody was like, holy crap, this is serious. They just took down 2 skyscrapers in New York, and nothing had happened like that since Pearl Harbor. And even Pearl Harbor was way off in distant Hawaii, which was just a territory at the time. So, yeah, it galvanized the nation, absolutely. And that was kind of a good feeling because you were ready to go. Now, fast forward 13 years later, there's a lot of tired folks in the military because it's been nonstop. It's been a long, long grind. And it goes from one mission to the next. So. Interesting, though.
Just being sent multiple places.
Oh, yeah, multiple times, yeah.
So did you kind of, it's probably on your bio.
Yeah, you might have to dig.
But so did you go straight from that Philippines mission and then moved into Afghanistan?
Not directly, no, because I came back from the Philippines mission and was moved to United States Special Operations Command in Tampa, Florida, to kind of have oversight over the Pacific because I was coming right out of the Pacific. And about a year and a half into that job, they said, hey, we need some more people over in Afghanistan. And I said, okay. You know, I volunteered for – it was a short tour, too. It was a six-month tour to go over and to work in the operations center for JSOC, and that's Joint Special Operations Command under United States Special Operations Command. There's a lot of layers. And they do a lot of the commando-type raids and those kind of things. So I went over in the winter, the December of 2004, and stayed until the spring of 2005. And what's interesting about Afghanistan is you have lulls in fighting, and the winter is usually the lull in the fighting because the weather is so bad and the snow is so deep. The bad guys go to ground, and so do the good guys. It's just you almost go into survival mode because you have these remote base camps up on the friendly side out there. And the roads get just so bad that you have to fly all their supplies in. So it really becomes just a logistical game of moving fuel and food and medicine or whatever out to these camps during the winter months. Then the fighting season begins every spring in Afghanistan. And that's when everything heats up again. So it was pretty quiet during the winter that I was there. And then it picked up again right towards the end. And my job was the deputy chief of operations. So I would be on the floor of this big – basically kind of a warehouse type setup with you had television, big flat screen televisions with predator feeds we used to call it Predator TV, or the nickname was Predator Porn, because everybody would sit there and stare at it, because you could watch the raids going in and taking down, you know, a Taliban stronghold at night. It was all in thermal imagery. It was pretty fun to watch. Sit there and you watch popcorn. But you'd also be monitoring it and then sending in the medevac birds or whatever you needed to do. So it was one of those jobs where you never had a day off, and you were on 12 on and 12 off. And then the 12 off included whatever sleep you wanted and then a couple meals. So it was one of those grinds. You're like, oh, man, when's this going to end? But you felt you were doing worthy work. So that was the first time I went into Afghanistan. Then when I finished that job in Tampa, Florida, you know, came back from Afghanistan, signed out of there, and then I took a job in the Netherlands working for NATO. And the job there at NATO ended up being my job was to go around to the European countries that were sending special operations forces, like their commandos, into Afghanistan. And my job, since I'd been recently in Afghanistan, was to give them briefings on what to expect and then travel with them into Afghanistan and get them linked up with the nearest American units. Because in Afghanistan, like in many places, the Americans are running the show. They have the biggest forces. They have all the money. And so these European units would kind of attach themselves to American units for logistical support and security and everything else. And so my job was to make that happen, bring them in. I ended up going in with the Norwegian Special Operations and, with the Dutch. And I did some liaison with the French going into Afghanistan and did some work with the Canadians also. And it was a neat job because I was able to travel to every camp almost in Afghanistan. And the main four were – in the east, you had Kabul, the capital. In the north, you had a place called Mazi-Sharif, and that's where the Germans were in charge. Out west on the Iranian border was Herat, and that was the Spanish and the Italians. And down south was Kandahar, which was a huge American base. And it was also the closest to where all the Taliban would come in and out of Pakistan, where they had a safe haven where we couldn't attack into Pakistan. It's kind of similar to Vietnam. They would do their fighting and then run back across the border into Pakistan, where, you know, we technically couldn't get them. Now, of course, it just took very high level authority to go after them into Pakistan because you're violating another sovereign country. But that was kind of the first kind of couple go arounds in Afghanistan.
Compared to the other places that you went, which was kind of your favorite and your least favorite?
You know, I would say that. Oh, wow, that's a tough one. Probably the Philippines was a favorite just because it was, you know, just, man, it was tropical island stuff. And it was also a wet theater. When you weren't directly involved with fighting, you could go have a beer. Whereas Afghanistan and Iraq, they put in these draconian rules where there was no drinking at all, which really, you know, just causes people to lie, you know, because they're going to do it anyway. And so, you know, so you had some issues with that. Scenery-wise, probably Afghanistan was the most scenic. It, you know, it's mountainous. It's got snow. Sometimes it's bitter cold, and it's kind of snow mixed with dirt. But but it's scenic. Iraq was probably the least favorite just because it was the longest tour. That was a full 12 months, and that was a grind. And the summers are so hot, and you're wearing all that equipment all the time. I mean, it's 125, 130 degrees out, and then you're wearing about 40 pounds of gear. And you get real skinny real fast because you're just, you know, you're just dehydrating. You don't feel like eating. So, yeah. So I'd say, yeah, favorite the Philippines, right? Least favorite Iraq.
So. Okay. And kind of similar to that, what do you think your best day was in the military? Like, and you can take that as you want, like maybe a couple ways, and then your worst day.
Okay. Well, the best day was the day that I graduated from the Special Forces Scuba School down in Key West, because that is the hardest school. Unbelievable, because I've been to Ranger School and Special Forces and Survival and all these other schools, but Scuba School was tough. And there was a lot of – that was just a brutal school. And to graduate from that, great feeling. Worst day was it was probably – a day that we lost three guys, and it was 2013, it was just 2 years ago. I was the deputy commander of 1st Special Forces Group, and we'd lost men all along the way. A total of first groups lost 23, but in one day, It was our guys were out teaching Afghanis how to shoot on a range, and one of the Afghanis turned around and shot my three guys that were instructing them and killed them all. And so that was probably the toughest day because, you know, it was one of those deals. Like, you knew these guys, and then you knew their families. And every one of them was married with little kids. So brutal, brutal day, tough. And, just to watch that go down, yeah, that was probably the hardest.
I had a friend who was in Afghanistan here at, like, kind of the end. He was there last year. And
yeah.
He talked about that, like, there was so much tension between, because he said that you didn't even want to trust him because you'd heard stories like that. And he said that it was the weirdest thing to be around them even eating. And he said that it was just like you would sit in, like, I don't know if you call it, like, cafeteria or what,
right.
But it would just be, like, constant looking over the shoulder all the time. So,
yeah.
How do you like being retired? Is it?
That's kind of a new thing. I think, yeah, actually, it was the right time because I'm 50 years old now. When I first enlisted as a cook, I was 19. So I always joke with my wife. I said, you know, I've only had two jobs in life. I was a lifeguard and I've been a soldier really my whole life. So it was time. They always say that you know when it's time to go. And it was time to go. And the thing that really drove it home was my last parachute jump. It was a free fall jump in Shelton, Washington. We use a civilian airport out in Shelton. And we got up to about 15,000 feet. Beautiful day. You could see Mount Rainier. We were as high as Rainier. And it was a big free fall. And you'd free fall to about 4,000. So, and a great jump. Chute opened great at 4,000. I was flying in. And nice and flat and level, and I was about 100 feet off the ground, and I was over the airstrip itself, the concrete, and the heat was coming up from the airstrip, and I hit a thermal, and I turned sideways, and I just crashed. I came down really hard, and I was just like, oh, man. It was like you were in a WWF, you know, wrestling thing. Somebody just slammed you. And everything hurt, my ribs, my elbows, and I said, okay, it's time to go. I'm getting too old for this. So, yeah, so it's been good, and in fact, one of the dynamics I've had to deal with is just getting used to being at home, and my wife's been getting, you know, having trouble getting used to me because I've been home now for 3 straight months, and that's the longest we've ever been together in a row. And she's been looking at her watch, going, "Hey, buddy, don't you have somewhere to go?" Because I've always left, you know. And then she had her routine, and I'm kind of wrecking her groove. So I've actually picked up some contract work, and I leave for Belgium on Sunday for a couple of weeks, so that'll give her a break. So. But yeah, retirement's pretty good. It was time. Body's kind of beat up. So I was kind of going to go do something else and I guess grow up and get a real job.
So kind of what you talked about in your resume and then also in your bio and then also in some of the research. So it sounds like you trained guys a lot. So what was that? Kind of, what does that entail, and what is it kind of like from going from obviously being trained to now you're training these guys, what you've learned?
Well, you find that when you're a trainer, it makes you better at whatever skill that is because you really have to research what you're doing to be able to teach it. You can't teach it, and you can't wing it because people will see right through you. So you have to have some practical experience at it, and then you go into the teaching mode. And I find that's probably the most rewarding work there is. To be able to pass on knowledge and teach others. And I've taught both Americans and I've taught a lot of foreigners. In fact, I spent 3 years down in San Diego teaching diving to the Navy SEALs. They have an exchange program where the Army Special Forces guys go and teach some of the SEALs and the SEALs go over and teach some of our guys. But it was funny down there, a little segue. So San Diego, right, it's only about 90 miles from Hollywood. So there's all kinds of – you always have the filmmakers coming down. We had Discovery Channel come down all the time to do specials on the SEALs. And that was – we loved that because we got a day off because the Navy didn't want Discovery Channel seeing that Army was teaching Navy how to dive. So it was like, hey, all your Army guys, you can have the day off. Anytime the film crews were there. So it was like, yeah, free day on the beach. But anyway, so, you know, hone some instructor skills there. And then a lot of what the Army Special Forces, the Green Berets, do is they are instructors. It's a lot more cost-effective to send 12 American Green Berets to teach 500 indigenous guys how to do something, and therefore you don't have to send 500 Americans. You can use foreigners to, kind of, as long as their interests are the same as the U.S., to do the fighting. And because really we're spread pretty thin. You know, you got a 500,000-man army, and you got problems all over the world. So you really do need a force that can have people fight in for our national interests, you know, and theirs. But so we don't have to be everywhere at any one time.
And from what I understand, I've watched it on Netflix. It's this one documentary. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's about the Green Berets.
No, I haven't seen it.
Yeah. Oh, it looks terrifying, by the way. having to put puke in your pocket sounds horrible. Like, oh my God. But so your scuba training was harder than that, though, you said.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the scuba training is brutal, and a lot of it's self-induced, but it's when you get in the water, I mean, that's not our natural environment, right? And then especially when you get in the ocean at night and you have to go under it, you're definitely not at the top of the food chain. So you're like, wow. So there's all those things you got to deal with mentally, being, you know, underwater in the dark and swimming with a glowing compass, and that's all you can see. And, you know, the other things out there can see that glowing compass too, and you might be a snack. But and just the physical aspect of it, it is a brutal course. I mean, you're talking, you know, open ocean swims of, you know, 3,000 meters, which is, you know, a couple miles, and, you know, on a daily basis, plus work in the pool. And it's about 6 weeks long, 5.5 weeks to get through that course. It's a crusher. I mean, that's one of those you definitely do when you're still in your 20s. There's no way. I mean, you just couldn't do it later on in life. So, yeah, that was tough.
And you have to mentally prepare for those kind of trips.
Oh, yeah,
too.
Physically and mentally. You really do. And you do a train-up back at home station from guys that have already been through the course. They kind of work with you and – yeah, just stuff like having to swim 50 meters underwater on one breath hold. You can't come up. That's a long way. So you're like, geez. So, yeah. And things like that, just to be able to, you know, condition yourself. You work, you know, you work up to it several months.
Nice. Yeah. My friend told me to ask you this because he said it was his favorite question to be asked and no one ever asks him. What was like your favorite thing to get in packages that were sent to you, like packages?
Oh man, at the time, I used chewing tobacco. So to get a big roll of like Kodiak or Copenhagen was the heat, and good cigars. I've since quit nicotine. I had to grow up sometime, and you know, wanted to watch my daughters get married, so I didn't want to die. But it was always the nicotine was the best if it was fresh. Good cigars and tobacco. We always thought that was cool. I mean, we were always hoping there'd be maybe like a fifth of Jim Beam in that package. Never got it. So.
Okay. Let's see what other. So, what made you choose the Army?
Oh, to be honest, it was kind of the family business. You know, my dad was a soldier. My sister had gone in the Air Force, so I was like, no way I was going to do that. And I thought about the Navy, but it was really by default. You know, that it was what I was familiar with, and it was easy to do.
If you were to go back, would you choose a different branch?
That's a really good question. Yeah, you know, if I would had to do it again, I would probably go and be a Navy SEAL because after I mean. And a lot of it's self-serving, but, man, they've got some good duty assignments. I mean, the Army, you got to go to, like, Georgia and Kentucky. And the Navy, you got basically two places, San Diego or Virginia Beach. I mean, how hard is that? You know, right? So it was like, the quality of life is a big thing. And, yeah, those cats definitely have it. With, you know, you're on the beach. So probably, yeah, if I had to do it again, I'd go Navy.
If you were younger and you could go back, do you think you'd still choose joining?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, no regrets at all. It's been a great adventure. Got to see the world, you know, many, many places. And it was good for my kids, too, because I have little girls, and they've lived in Japan, Korea, the Netherlands, Washington State, Montana, and Florida. So they've had a good run, too, so they're well-rounded. So, yeah, I mean, it's just been good for everybody. I mean, you're never going to get rich in the military, but you're never going to starve to death either. So it's a pretty good solid. And there's pride. You know, anytime you can be part of something bigger than yourself, you know, there's self-fulfillment and self-actualization, you know what I'm trying to say, with anything like that. And that's one of those deals.
And then you said that you're an Army brat, so did you move around a lot when you were a kid, too?
I did. Yeah, absolutely. What the heck, you know, I lived in Korea, Washington State, Virginia, Georgia, Tennessee, California.
Cool.
Yeah.
this one's classic. Okay, what were some life lessons you learned from military service?
Well, you learned, number one, that no one gets through life on their own. you know, it takes a lot of assistance, encouragement, support from either, you know, family or buddies and everything else. I think number two, the most important thing I learned is if you take care of the people that work for you, they'll always take care of you. You know, advice, if just trying to, you know, advance yourself for selfless reasons, that always implodes. I've seen so many people go down in flames because they're either toxic or it was all about them. But if, you know, if you just took care of the folks, you know, that worked for you, God, they always took care of you, and it worked out for me. And I reached a fairly high rank in the Army by just doing that, not worrying about, you know, so much, you know, oh, was I going to get promoted? It was just worrying about those folks and making sure they were okay, their families were okay. And then that instilled loyalty. And they was like, wow, they would do anything for you. And they covered my butt so many times that I'd make mistakes or screw something up. It just disappeared because they had been taken care of. And so it worked out fine. And then I guess the third thing that I learned is that, you know, the human condition, we're all pretty much the same on this planet. You know, all the different cultures, there's nuances that are different and culturally, but really everybody has the same wants and needs. You know, they want to be successful. They want to have food. They want their family to be protected. And you see that throughout all the different cultures. It doesn't matter if they're Muslim or if they're Hindu or they're Christian or whatever. It's kind of the same deal. Basically, you know, if those needs are met, you don't have all these issues. And that's really, I think, why we have so many problems in the Middle East. There's all the haves and way too many have-nots that have no other recourse. Like these ISIS jokers. I mean, they've got nothing to lose in their mind, so they're just having a blast. They're just cutting people's heads off and running crazy through the streets. It's like a free-for-all. I mean, there's no way that's going to last because that's just untenable and just disgusting. But, you know, so anyway, you learn that. You learn that people, you know, they just have basic needs. And if they're busy and productive and making a difference somewhere, they're sure as heck not going to fight and, you know, and start a war because there's no need to. So I guess those are kind of the three things I've learned.
Watching, like, the news and seeing little activity, like the ISIS stuff that's going on, does it make you wish that you were still in it? It's pretty fresh. Were you leaving? So
no, actually, no. I'm done. It's like it's time for, you know, there's plenty more, you know, people that are younger, have a lot more endurance and good on them, and I'll cheer them on and all that. But there's always somebody to fill your shoes in the military. So, yeah, I feel, you know, I'm proud of the stuff I've accomplished, but, yeah, I don't need to go back. It's time to do a little fly fishing and some more deer hunting and everything else. So.
You picked a good state for it.
Yeah, right.
So how has wartime experiences affected your life?
Well, it's definitely, there's been strain on the family. The long absences have been tough. And there were some issues we had to overcome when I got back, you know, with my kids, and you know, because Dad had been gone so much, and that takes a toll. It makes them a little more insecure, and they weren't quite sure, was Dad ever going to come home? Because they were savvy enough to understand the kind of work that I did. It was definitely out there in the mix. So yeah, there was strain on the family. I think we're doing some healing right now. The Dad's home all the time. I get up every morning, fix everybody breakfast, and have a good time with that because I never got to do that before. So that was pretty neat. But what else? You know, on the positive side, you just met some fantastic people from all across the country. You're just great Americans out there, you know, just doing cool stuff. And not all of them are in the military. A lot of contract workers and medical people and just, you know, out there. And journalists, too. Really some real good ones. I mean, journalists, sometimes, you know, you get this, you know, a stigma. Oh, they're going to, you know, just out for the dirt and the scoop and everything else just to, you know, to sell advertising. And that's not true. There were some people that really, really cared. And they wanted to, you know, find out the truth. And the neat thing about our country and the freedom of speech thing, the journalism, you know, journalists help keep people honest, you know, because you're out there, hey, it's, you know, if they're truly, you know, professionals, they're giving an unbiased look and telling the truth. And that keeps a lot of times leadership from glossing over the truth or twisting it. So I think that was kind of neat, too, just to see the people, you know, throughout these combat scenarios where you're out of your normal environment, you're into a stressful situation, and you saw the best and worst out of people in those kind of those issues. People doing some great heroic stuff, and then you saw some debauchery too. You know, people are away from home, and you know, using the stress of war to get away with stuff or to write off things they shouldn't be doing. So you saw both sides. It's just the human condition, kind of stripped away and raw. I think is kind of a interesting way to see it.
I'm looking here if I can.
Sure.
It. These questions are usually, like, they're pretty dry, but, So, political science. Let's see. This one may not spark a different answer from you, but how has the military service impacted your feelings about war and the military in general?
It's a deep question.
Right?
Yeah. Well, war, it really hasn't changed it, because I think, unfortunately, there's always going to be conflict. You know, and the sad thing is, it's almost always economically driven. So, to be honest, these wars have all been about oil and in control of the Middle East. I mean, it really has. The politicians can say they're not. That's BS. Because if there wasn't oil in the Middle East, there's no way in heck we'd even be there. It's hot. It's nasty. And everything else. It just has cheap petrol. So, if we start drilling our own, hopefully we won't have to go fight over there anymore and get tangled up in a culture that is so contrary to ours, with Islam and everything else, and they're anti-us. It's just the friction points are just too many. I realize it makes you sad when you lose really good people. So that affects you, and you're like, wow, I would hope that, the leadership of this country would think long and hard before they ever commit troops. I mean, and it's too bad that you can't require politicians to serve first and to actually go feel it, because then maybe they'd be a little less, hesitant to go, let's go get them. Because every time you do that, sons and daughters are going to die. And so that's tough. I don't know. What was the second part? It was like.
So your feelings are more in the military in general.
I still think the military, it's a good institution. It's fairly self-policing. Now, anytime I think you have a long endurance war, like Vietnam was long, we're still technically at war after 13 years. Something's happened, and you see some human frailties, like, General Petraeus and his biographer and, all the shenanigans that were going on with that. So, that's a little embarrassing, and I would hope that, the military would police its own. The military, it's the same. I think it's still a good institution. They try very, very hard to be fair and equitable. And I think the military, for a large institution, because you're looking, if you include all the National Guard, Reserves, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, probably, I don't know, 1.5 million folks, 2 million, something like that. For an organization that big, I think they get it about 75% right. They're not 100%. They make some mistakes, and sometimes they're pretty grievous, but – I'd say, 75% right. They do the best they can. I think they're trying.
Yeah. And you're always going to get bad eggs in a group anyways.
Yeah, percentage-wise, even if it's 1%, I mean, it's 100,000 right there. So.
Yeah, it's always going to happen. Yeah. And also, growing up, because your dad was in it, did you have a different – did it help you understand him a little bit better, I guess, when you were older?
Yeah, and that's a good way to speak. You did. It was like, oh, that's what he was going through. And you could, because when you get to the same point that you remember him at, like as a major, oh, I'm a major now. Ah, that makes sense. And it really was. There was no transition whatsoever. It was, I grew up in a military family, so it wasn't like, oh, boo-hoo, you're going off in the Army, It was, whatever. It was a good job and, move out, kid, and then my parents were happy. I was out of the house, and they weren't paying for anything anymore. So,
let's see. I love this question. Where were you when the war ended?
Hasn't ended. Yeah, we're still going.
How did you return home? Does not apply. You returned home multiple times.
Yeah, multiple times, and it was fine. You got off an airplane. the biggest deal, I guess, when I came back from Iraq, it was on a big troop rotator. That was the first time I'd done that. That was interesting because we stopped in Bangor, Maine, and you get greeted there, and they get fuel. And it's pretty neat because all these old-timers and vets are there, and they have a big corridor, and they're clapping and cheering when you get off the plane and handing you stuff and food, and you have about a two-hour layover, and very nice folks, and they did it for every dang plane that came out of Afghanistan or Iraq, and they still do it to this day. And they've got a big room. They count how many working dogs get off the plane and all this kind of stuff, and that was fun. And then you flew into Fort Benning, Georgia, and then they had a big auditorium, and all the families were there and all that stuff. So that was the only big ceremonial coming home. The rest of the time, it just got off the plane like you're getting off at SeaTac and, hey, what's up, grab a Starbucks, and the war's over. So for that tour.
That's funny because like all that you ever see in the media is like, yay, and then it's like you just.
Yeah.
How's it going?
That's yeah, so exactly. Funny. What's the Seahawks score, man?
Yeah. You know? Yeah, that's funny. God. Sometimes I always wonder that when I'm in SeaTac, if they're like coming back from somewhere else or if they're just coming back to JBL.
And you never know. Some of them are, some of them aren't. A lot of the Special Forces guys will be in civilian clothes. A lot of the regular Army kids might be in their, you know, camouflage because that's all they had. They weren't allowed to bring any civilian clothes. So you never know.
Are you a member of any veterans organizations?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, sure. The American Legion and the Special Forces Association. And those are good because they the American Legion helps you with any claims you've got with the Veterans Administration, any disabilities or, you know, whatever happened, your knees blew out. And then the Special Forces Association is neat because it's all guys that you served in the same kind of specialty, and we take care of our wounded guys and guys that got torn up, and we bring them out here to Montana to fly fish and hunt and all that kind of stuff. And we, you know, and people have been very generous in this state. We get car dealers donating, you know, rental cars and, you know, everything else to take care of these kids and their families. So yes, those two organizations in particular.
Yeah, that's the one that isn't there one that has them make like art right now too?
Yeah,
something like that. They come with like it's. If you have, like, PTSD, they'll send you out into a program sometimes or something.
Right.
Something like that.
Yeah.
A kid did a project on it, and I thought it was really interesting.
Yeah.
It's funny to see all of these guys. Like, it was a video of it, and there were a couple of them that were in, like, uniform. And it was just funny to watch them, like, throwing clay in, like, a uniform.
Right. It's like, what?
Like, usually I have a gun in your hand. I'm so confused. But... Okay, and so did you see frontline action?
Oh, yeah, because there really in Afghanistan, Iraq, and the Philippines, there was no frontline. So, and what's interesting, as I say, I've been shot at in the Philippines and Afghanistan and Iraq, and it's kind of the same. The first time it happens, it's the weirdest sensation because you don't even realize you're getting shot at because it sounds like supersonic bumblebees going past you. They just go zick, zick. And you go, what the heck is that? And that's obviously the little bullet breaking the sound barrier. And if you can hear it, they're really close. And that's the sound. It's like, zick. It just goes right. You go, whoa, what was that? And then your brain kind of clicks. And you're, whoa, survival instinct. And pretty soon you're leaving, like, nose tracks in the dirt, man. You're just crawling just to stay low enough so you don't get shot. But, yeah, and I remember one time in Iraq, we had a little team house inside an Iraqi compound. And some joker blew up a car bomb. It was about 100 yards from our building, and it just blew the glass out. And I was in there, I was cleaning a weapon or something, or messing around with my computer. I just remember being really pissed off because I got dirt in my coffee. I was so pissed because we'd gotten Starbucks, had been sending all this free coffee over, and I'd finally gotten a hold of some. It was the first pot of Starbucks I'd brewed, and these assholes fucking blew up this car bomb, just blew the glass out. I got glass and dirt in my canteen cup. I was like, it just kind of—I was angry. I was ready to go kick some ass at that point. So yes. And then we get shot at quite a bit flying around because you're a target. Because, you know, the bad guys didn't have any helicopters, so all helicopters in the sky were ours. And you could, you know, anytime we fly over Sadr City in Baghdad, you'd take a few rounds and, you know, same thing. It's like, man. At night you can see the tracers, which are, you know, it's phosphorus on the rounds. They streak through the sky. Daytime it's harder to see them. Just, you know, is what it is.
What kinds of friendship and camaraderie did you form while serving? You talked about it just kind of like having each other's backs, but obviously like with the team.
And with the Special Forces units, we're together for years. Like in my instance, the first Special Forces group out of Washington State is where they're all stationed. We've known each other since we were in our 20s, and now we're all 50. And so we grew up on teams together, and just within kind of a fairly tight circle, the same guys. So, I mean, lifelong bonds. I'm in touch with all of them all the time. They're always razzing me, you know, sending text messages, you know, daily, and talk to these guys. But these are lifetime bonds. They're very, very close because you've done crazy stuff together. You dove in the ocean, jumped out of airplanes, gone to war, and all that. So, yeah, strong, super strong bonds.
Did you witness a lot of, like, casualties within your group?
I don't say a lot. It was often enough where you knew what to do. It was a battle drill. of, you know, how the notification process went and everything else. And like I said, in my unit, there was 23 killed in action and probably 140, 150, maybe more that have been wounded. It was fairly constant. We had one stretch in, was it 2013? And a three-month stretch, we had five killed and there's like 25 wounded. It was just a bad time. And for that stretch, my job back at Fort Lewis was actually I was the guy to break the news to the families and, you know, get them organized and everything else. That took more of a toll on me than actually being over with the guys and where the stuff was happening. That was tough, you know, dealing with the new widows. I mean, here's a girl who's, you know, 23 years old and now she's a widow with two kids. You know, tough stuff. You know, you have all this great, bright, free future ahead of them, and, you know, kind of altered a little bit, you know, completely changed course. So that was interesting. But, you know, a lot of them, I found the stronger their faith was, the better they did. Like one widow told me, she goes, hey, he just beat me to the finish line. You know, I'll see him again. And that kind of faith, I think, is really critical to get her through that. I mean, she weathered it better than any of the rest of them. Real strong Catholic family. And that was her way of dealing with it. She goes, oh, yeah, yeah. You know, life is over in a blip anyway when you look back on it. And she goes, yeah, I'll see him again. It won't be that long. So.
That's crazy. Yeah. That would be the worst job ever.
Yeah.
So how did you stay in touch with your family while you were away?
Well, fortunately, you know, with modern technology, it's gotten better and better and scarier since 2001. Email was a big deal in 2001, and you really couldn't text anything. And then this really cool thing called Skype came along. It was like, holy moly, you can see them live. And that was real good. And it was actually, in the military does a good job setting up Skype centers. And, you know, it's all free, and the GIs can talk daily if they want to their family, which I think sometimes annoys the family. That's a little too much. But, you know, but on the converse of that, it's dangerous too, because if somebody gets wounded, you've got people telling their wives about Joe next door. And then so you really have to – anytime there was a casualty, you had to lock down all the phones, all the internet, and everything else to make sure until the notifications were made to the actual family. You have to lock down whole bases on that stuff. So it's something that has to be controlled. But yeah, easy to talk to folks worldwide. It's nuts. It's so easy. So.
Right there. So this just simply says, how did you readjust to civilian life? But I have a little bit more specific. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like you've been in combat. Mm-hmm. Coming back, is it harder to, I have a friend who said that the first couple of weeks he couldn't stand walking around like malls or grocery stores. Mm-hmm. Just because like you're so used to somewhere where, like you said, there's like car bombs going off and dust getting in your coffee.
Oh, yeah.
Back to just boring civilian life.
Well, yeah, you don't like crowds. So, you know, telling Missoula is fine because it's not that crowded. Seattle's a little, you get a little edgy just because you're a little claustrophobic, just too many people because you're used to being dialed in and watching everybody. And then the other thing is you had trouble getting used to is not having a weapon with you all the time. Because, you know, over there you'd have your rifle with you, and then we always said you had, you know, a pistol under your pillow. Everything was loaded all the time. And for a long time, I still kept a pistol under the pillow, even at home. It was a comfort thing. It had to be there. I could feel it with my head where the lump was, and that was good, and I could sleep. So, yeah, there's a little bit of an adjustment. So you can finally – it takes time just to kind of dial down so you don't have to be vigilant all the time that somebody's trying to kill you.
Yeah. And do you think – I'm sure you can't speak for all of them, but do you think most guys feel that way when they come home?
I think to some degree, sure, yeah. And you throw that on top of the other stressors where you're coming back into an environment. If you're married, your wife's got her own routine going on, and now you're kind of wrecking that. So there's some stress. I mean, there's always a good, you know, honeymoon homecoming, and then you start to get on each other's nerves and, you know, everything else. You have to be – and we take a long time talking to our guys about, hey, man, you know, she's been running the show, dude. You're not in charge anymore. You know, you'll work your way back into whatever your, you know, agreement is, but for now, let her run it. Because she has been. She's doing a damn good job anyway. So, you know, lay off. And that just takes time and readjustment. I'm still readjusting with my wife now. Because this has been like a 20 – we've been married for 21 years. Yeah, 21 years we've been apart, kind of, you know, seeing each other about half a year. Now it's full time. So it's good drama.
So what kind of work are you doing now that you're retired?
Yeah, retired. Well, I got. Yeah, I have to do something like to save the marriage, just to get out of the house. But so I've hired on with a defense contractor, and so now I'm going over to Europe and I'm teaching European staff officers how to work in an operations center in Afghanistan before they go. So it's their pre-deployment training for, you know, you might be German officers and French and Norwegian and Brits or whatever. So it's my comfort zone. It's easy because I know the work. It's nothing hard. It's not like I have to put on a suit and go to corporate America. So then it gives everybody a break. I get to go away from home for a little while and my wife can, you know, breathe.
So. And do whatever
she
does.
Right.
Would you ever want your daughters to enlist?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, great opportunity out there. And, you know, just, you know, a million jobs you can pick from. Sure, I think it's a good experience, you know, to go out and do something, and it's kind of neat, so sure.
Okay. Let's see. I'll make sure that I have all of my questions before I ask you my final questions. What did you do for recreation when you were off duty?
In the combat zones?
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Lift a lot of weights, you know, hang out in the gym. The Army and the military in general did a great job putting together some really good gyms. What else would we do? We'd shoot rats. There was lots of rats in Iraq and Afghanistan, so that was kind of a sport, and just nailing those suckers. I think that's really not off duty. Yeah, but everything kind of revolved around meal times and going to the gym, lifting weights. If you weren't out on a mission, getting in touch with home, doing this Skype and emailing, and that was pretty much it. I mean, there was a couple guys who were running some stills and making some beer. You know, to be honest, yeah, of course, you know, bootleg stuff, and, you know, I might have provided some technical advice. Yeah. I'm retired now, I can say that. Yeah, there was some shenanigans going on, sure.
Put you on the front line questions. When you went in, did your dad give you any advice?
He told me, oh, yeah, the one thing he did tell me, the only thing he told me was never take anything personal in the military. He said, you know, basically have a thick skin. It's a big machine. It's not like they're out to get you. You know, things don't go your way. It's not because they don't like Max Carpenter. It's just because it's a big machine. It's a big insensitive organization at times. So that was the advice. Just don't take anything personal. Just say, you know, dust yourself off if you fall down and just move out. So that was it.
Do you have any punishment stories of, like, where you fell a little bit out of line and then you had to do a crazy workout or anything like that?
Yeah, what was it? It was the battalion commander was in the 3rd Ranger Battalion. He had a get-together with all the officers and their wives at his house. And all his bathrooms were full. There's kind of a pattern here. So I was out with a buddy in the backyard, and we were peeing on a bush. And then we turned around, and there he was, standing in the doorway. It was night, but yeah, you could see him silhouetted. He goes, "See me in my office Monday morning, 07. So, yeah, we showed up in his office, and we had to go do a 25-mile road march. That day, you know, we had to go get our backpacks and walk for 25 miles, and that sucked. But, yeah, that was kind of the one punishment that sticks out in my mind. That, I remember. That's like
at his own house.
Yeah.
Like buddies, like you were invited to his house.
Oh, yeah. It was a party, but all the bathrooms were full, so me and another guy walked out back. We're just, you know, yeah, she used the bushes, and then he was like, conduct unbecoming of an officer is what he called it. I was like, really?
Could you imagine if you could do that with, like, your civilian friends? Oh, yeah. Like, if you pee on my, you know, or, like, your neighbors with their dog.
Right. Oh, yeah. You leave a pile in the yard, like, come here, you. Make him do a 25-mile road march.
I don't think any of my neighbors would make it at all. Let's see. So you received your specialized training. So I guess, like, we're getting close to the end. I'm fulfilled most of my question requirements that I have.
Okay.
Plus just stuff that I was wondering. Are there any stories you want to share that are like some of your favorite stories?
Yeah, there's. Let me tell you this story. This was the story of bringing the Nepalese Gurkhas to Haiti. And it was an interesting journey. So getting to Kathmandu is an adventure in itself. There's no easy way to get there. And it's a very weird place because Kathmandu sits about a mile high. And then right behind us, the Himalayas goes up to Mount Everest in 29,000. And the most dangerous airport in the world from international airport, more crashes there and everything else. And it just has a weird aura in that city. It's kind of a mix of kind of monks wearing the saffron robes, lots of incense burning, lots of smoke, holy cows walking around through the streets because they're Hindu. And, you know, so they don't, you know, the cows have lays of flowers around them and they just walk around and crap on the sidewalk. And then Euro trash, like guys, heroin addicts and mountain climbers. That's kind of the mix. So we land here with the Special Forces A team, you know, 12 guys. So we're going to train up these Nepalese, and we do it for 5 weeks. And we've all gone through like just heinous diarrhea and everything else. I mean, the food's just that. I mean, good curry, but it's dirty. So anyway, so we finally, we got to bring in these U.S. Air Force aircraft. We're going to take them out 100 at a time in these old C-141 Starlifters, they used to call them. These are regular Air Force guys coming from Scott Air Force Base, Illinois. Well, we had to get up on the tower of the international airport to bring them in because the radios wouldn't work from the Nepalese. So we're calling in the aircraft, and we have to have a Jeep run up and down the runway to get the holy cows off the runway because we're bringing in jets. So we finally get them in. We get the Nepalese all lined up, and they bring their families to say goodbye because they're going from, like, the Stone Age to the Space Age. And they're bringing tambourines, and they're throwing that saffron and maroon dye all over the place. And they're throwing it all over the airplane to bless it. And the Air Force guys are getting all stressed out. Their airplane's just coated in pink and yellow powder. I'm like, whoa, this is pretty wild. And this captain's like, this is crap. I go, just let them do it. And then they go, watch this. And then the Nepalese, they brought out a goat, and they cut its head off to sacrifice. And they're spraying goat blood all over the nose cone of the U.S. Air Force aircraft. And I was laughing my ass off. I was like, this is funny. So anyway, so we get them into the aircraft. The families are still out there banging on tambourines and chanting and all this stuff to bless them. We shut up the aircraft. And they start firing up the engines. And the loadmaster goes, hey, Carpenter, you want to see something funny? I go, yeah, what's up? And we can look out the window, and he goes, here goes the engines. Well, the aircraft, the tail end of it was right next to a little, like, cliff, and all the families were there. When they turned on all four jet engines, it blew the families right off the hill. I don't know what happened to them. I guess maybe we cooked them. They were, like, gone. It wasn't that far of a drop, maybe 5 to 7 feet, but all the families got blown away. I was like, and we took off. But, you know, you're in a military aircraft. There's only a couple windows, so none of these guys, the Nepalese, saw that their families got blown off the hill. So I don't know what happened to them. So we get up to altitude. And they start taking the little mask that you put on for oxygen on. And I go, and then one officer spoke English. I go, hey, Haji, come here, man. What are you guys doing? They go, they have used up all the air in the aircraft. And I go, shut up. I go, stop it. Take those off. So this is kind of the beginning of the end already. I'm like, oh, no. So after a while, it's time to feed them. These are all Hindus. They don't eat beef. And the crew chief goes, hey, there's a pallet of MREs over there, meals ready to eat. And I said, okay, cool. Let's feed these guys. So I started handing out the meals. And I'm looking like, oh, crap, they're all beef. But I was like, no, whatever, here you go. And so they're in a vinyl plastic pouch, and these guys thought they were pillows, so they're sleeping on them. So we had to have, like, a class on how to eat these things. And they're eating them. They thought this is the best ever. And the one English-speaking officer, he goes, Captain Carpenter, what kind of meat is this? And I go, it's pork. Don't worry about it. He goes, oh, okay. So I'm probably going to burn in Hindu hell somewhere. So anyway, so we get and we're going to go into our first aerial refueling over Africa. So we're up there, and it's real bumpy when you refuel because one plane plugs into a tanker at altitude, so it's bumpy and you're all over the place, and it's nasty. Like, you get very, you know, motion sick. So I go up in the cockpit to watch the refuel, and I come back down, and the 75 Nepalese on my plane, they puked all over the place. They got sick from these beef MREs. I'm like, wow, man. So it took about 6 hours to clean this stuff up, and we're starting to come into Port-au-Prince. And one of my medics had given me a big bag of Benadryl for motion sickness because it works. It puts you to sleep and you don't get sick. So I started – it was time to feed these guys again. So I fed every one of them like 3 Benadryls. And these are 90-pound dudes. So they were like looped. Man, like, woo. They couldn't wake up and they all fell asleep. And we touched down in Port-au-Prince and I'm up in the cockpit. And the pilot goes, hey, are you expecting anybody? I go, nah, man, it's just, you know, my team will be here, some trucks. And he goes, well, look over there across the runway. And the 25th Infantry Division band is there, and all the media is there. I went, holy crap. And he goes, yeah. He goes, you guys are the first UN troops to come in, these Nepalese. So they brought out the big brass. I go, taxi as slow as you can. So I'm wearing shorts and a T-shirt. I'm, like, looking for my uniform. I'm putting a helmet on, and I'm shaking these guys. They're all drugged up on Benadryl, and they can't wake up. Like, ah. So finally, I kind of got them halfway dressed, and, you know, the ramp drops. And, man, it opens up. And these guys are stumbling off the back of the ramp, and the band's going, and welcome, the new UN troops. And they just look like a bunch of drugged-out rag bags. I'm like, oh, my God, what did I do? And there's Christiane Ahnenpohr, and she sticks a microphone in my face. And she goes, would you like to comment on the, you know, the arrival of the UN? I went, no. And I got in the truck and took off. And just for the record, Christiane Ahnenpohr has a mustache. I've seen it. So anyway, so that was kind of the Haiti story, getting the first UN troops into Haiti. It was the big adventure. It was about a four-day trip. So anyway, you asked for it. You got it. So.
That's too good.
Yeah.
I love it. Is there anything else you'd like to say about your service?
So it was a good ride. You know, I mean, no regrets. It was fun. I got to see a lot of really cool stuff. And I feel blessed I was able to do that, because not everybody can, you know, get through the physical part and everything else. And feel very blessed also that I got to come home, because a lot of guys didn't. And that's unfortunate. Tragically unfortunate. And as long as we take care of their families, I think that's what we owe to them. So that's about it.
Cool. Thank you so much.
Now, I hope that works for you.
Yeah.
And if there's anything else, really.